Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Francine Klagsbrunn, author of Lioness, Golda Meir, and the Nation of Israel. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot, Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Today is Shavuot, Shavuos, the least appreciated and celebrated of the three major pilgrimage festivals. In fact, the major Jewish holiday that definitely has the worst PR of all. Conceptually, this is a very difficult thing to understand, since Shavuos remembers one of the most, if not the single most important event our people ever experienced. Shavuot is also the Feast of Weeks, called Pentecost in Latin, because it completes 50 days from Passover, the Festival of Freedom, to Shavuot, on the 50th day after the beginning of Pesach, from freedom to revelation. In practical terms, Shavuot has never had the buzz of Passover or even Sukkot. That's partly because Shavuot may be the Feast of Weeks, but unlike the pilgrimage festival cousins, it lasts just one day, or two if you are conservative or orthodox and happen to live outside of Israel. Blink and you'll miss Shavuos, which isn't true for all the other Jewish festivals, more or less. While Passover celebrates freedom from slavery for a full week and more, and Sukkot is the holiday of the harvest for 8 days, Shavuot celebrates revelation at Mount Sinai, God revealing to us the Ten Commandments, or at least us receiving the Ten Commandments. That's a more specific and less universal theme than that of the other holidays. You know, harvest, freedom, they belong to everybody. Ah, but the Torah is ours. It is powerful, Shavuot, and extremely important. You know, without it, you don't really have Judaism at all, but it's also harder in modern times to wrap our minds around. All of which shouldn't mean that we don't celebrate this wonderful festival today, which recalls our closest connection to God ever. After all, Shavuot is the festival of Matan Toratenu, the giving of our Torah, or perhaps better, the Kabbalat Ol HaTorah, the receiving of this responsibility of Torah. And so to celebrate that great gift, and to play us in this morning, here's a beautiful cantor and choral selection from Chazan Alberto Mizrahi, Adonai Adonai, from the Torah service itself, for this festival.
Oh.
That was Adonai Adonai, the Shlosh Esrei Midot, the 13 Qualities of God, chanted by cantor Abe Mizrahi for the holiday of Shavuot, festival of receiving the Torah at Sinai that we celebrate today. Our guest this morning is also celebrated, author Francine Klagsbrunn, whose outstanding biography of the great Israeli leader and Prime Minister Golda Meir has just been published in paperback. Meet her and find out what made Golda Meir such an extraordinary figure in Jewish history when we return in a moment on this Shavuot morning here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, the distinguished author Francine Klagsbrunn. She's the author of the now paperback version of the book Lioness, Golda Meir and the Nation of Israel, a past National Jewish Book Award winner, and really an extraordinary writer. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
So as Golda Meir gets farther and farther back into history, what are people missing about her?
I think they're missing that she was really a great woman. I don't think young people don't remember or know much about it to begin with, but even people who remember her remember this sort of Jewish mother, this nice lady. I don't think they realize her greatness. She was very, very smart, made terrific decisions, military decisions, things that you would not expect a woman who was untrained in military or diplomacy, won many friends for Israel in her time, and governed the country in a way that gave them a great deal of pleasure for a long time until the very end.
So how did this Wisconsin-born woman end up as the first female prime minister of Israel and such a powerful figure?
She was an extraordinary woman.
By the way, I shouldn't say Wisconsin-born. She actually was born in Russia.
That's right. She was born in Kiev. But she came to Wisconsin when she was 8 years old, so you're almost right.
Almost right. Yeah, Milwaukee, I think, right? Sorry about that.
Yeah, and she lived there until she was about 23, so she really grew up in the United States. So it is seems like an anomaly for a so-called American woman to have achieved what she did in Palestine and then Israel. But she was so dedicated to Zionism, then to the State of Israel, and to the Jewish people all over. She was very strong-minded. She was very ambitious herself. She wanted to get ahead. She wanted to be a leader. And she was very confident of her leadership and was able to do it. So I think that combination and the fact that she was, in a sense, the only woman committed at that time. There were women in Israel that were very dedicated feminists, and there are women in Israel writing biographies about those terrific feminists today. But that's not who Golda was. She was not a particularly dedicated to feminism, but she was looking to the state as a whole, to the country as a whole, and was the only woman in place at that time doing that, and also smart enough to be able to get her ideas across.
And of course, she understood America, and that became a very important part and a very valuable part of her service to the Zionist cause and to Israel. And we'll talk much more about that and many other subjects with Francine Klagsbrunn when we continue in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, is celebrating its first services, classes, holidays, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vital community and a vibrant one that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell for Shabbat services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah study is at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, our rich array of summer adult education academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675, that's 276-5675. Or go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona during its exciting first year. We are pleased to continue a new feature of Too Jewish, a recurring one now. It's called Three Truths My Bubby's Talmud Told Me. A bubby is a grandmother. Three Truths My Bubby's Talmud Told Me. Gentiles leave and don't say goodbye. Jews say goodbye and don't leave. If it tastes good, it's probably not really kosher. And where there's smoke, there may be smoked salmon. Those were three truths my Bubby's Talmud told me, a special feature of Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows, streaming them from our website or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You recently returned from Morocco and Spain. We started talking about the remarkable experiences you had there. And, of course, that was a center of Jewish culture, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, for hundreds of years. Tell us a little bit about, I think you wanted to start with
Morocco. Right. So we really visited three cities, one of which we visited for less than half a day. That was Meknes. Morocco has four imperial cities where the king maintains palaces, and he actually resides in each of those cities several nights at least per year to show that every part of the country and every tribe is part of one nation, blah, 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 and he puts this into actions. The city that we visited for less than half a day was Meknes, which has a big, impressive Jewish cemetery and a Talmud Torah and a few other things, but no surviving Jewish community whatsoever.
We should mention that before the Moroccan Jewish community was allowed to leave in the 50s and 60s, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews in the Jewish community in Morocco. Some people think 750,000. I've heard 600,000, very large
community. And some people say 250,000.
That's also true.
Whatever. But, and, you know, they always were allowed to leave, quote unquote, but it's a question of where to leave to.
Right.
Morocco until 56 was somehow a French protectorate. So you could go from one part of France to another with no problem. And a lot of cities in southern France developed largely Moroccan Jewish communities already in the 50s. Things started to change there, not so much as a result of the independence of the State of Israel, which is true most other places in the Arab world, but as a result of the Sinai War and most particularly the Six-Day War in 67. But to get back to our trip, so Fez has the richest Jewish past of anywhere in Morocco. It produced a lot of great rabbis and thinkers and had a very influential Jewish community. And Fez, in many ways, is the Athens of Morocco in terms of culture and history, philosophy, poetry, great writing. It's the home of one of the oldest universities in the world, the Cairoine University, that was founded by a lady from Cairoan. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and Cairoan was also a great center of Jewish culture and Jewish learning in Tunisia. This whole world was interconnected and was also interconnected even in the times of the Roman Empire, long before Islam came and settled and conquered. And there were Jews there before there were Muslims. And Moroccans recognized that. And Jews, generally speaking, were protected by the king, who regarded them as his most loyal subjects, the ones least likely to rebel or to cheat him. So the Jewish quarter in every city is located very near the imperial palace, if there is one. And it's called the Melach because
Jews were in charge of the salt trade?
Right.
That was always my guess.
The king gave them a royal monopoly on the salt trade, which was all the caravan routes across the Sahara to and from Timbuktu. And they
lived... So exotic, doesn't it? By the way, of course, Melach, Hebrew word for salt.
Right.
And Arabic also.
And they lived in, you know, densely populated neighborhoods, very in the shadow, literally, of the palace. And some of these neighborhoods had dozens of synagogues. There are remnants of these old synagogues, some of which have been restored in Fez, and there's a very well-maintained Jewish cemetery in Fez, but there's virtually no active living Jewish community. I mean, there's maybe two dozen Jews. There's no such thing as a regular minyan or a regular service. Marrakesh, however, is a very different story, and we'll get to that next week.
We'll talk about that next week. I do remember visiting, I think, Maimonides' house in Fez when I was there. He lived there at one point.
It's now a Chinese restaurant.
Yes. We'll talk next week, Tom. Thanks.
Okay.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A priest and rabbi sit next to each other on an airplane. After a while, the priest turns to the rabbi and says, "Is it still a requirement of your faith that you not eat pork?" And the rabbi responds, "Yes, that's still one of our beliefs." The priest then asks, "Have you ever eaten pork?" And the rabbi replies with a sigh, "Yes, on one occasion I did succumb to temptation and tasted a ham sandwich." The priest nods in understanding and goes on reading. A little while later, the rabbi speaks up and asks the priest, "Father, is it still a requirement of your church that you remain celibate?" The priest replies, "Yes, that is still very much a part of our faith." The rabbi then asks him, "Father, have you ever fallen to the temptations of the flesh?" The priest replies with a sigh, "Yes, Rabbi, on one occasion I was weak and broke with my faith." The rabbi nods understandingly. He's silent for a little while, and then he says, "Beats a ham sandwich, doesn't it?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shinshiniot, our young representatives on Israel, Ron Berakot and Rotem Rappaport. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
And Chag Sameach. Happy
Chag
Shavuot.
Chag Sameach.
So the Shavuot's incredibly important religiously, but not always so important culturally for American Jews. We received the Ten Commandments at Sinai. It happened a long time ago. It's only one day. Cheesecake, study a little bit, you're done. It's not like Pesach here. It's not like Hanukkah. But in Israel, because of the agricultural components and other reasons, tell us about Shavuot for you guys. It's a bigger deal.
So it's one of my favorite holidays. I think it's actually really fun for me, just because it's at the end of the school year. So there's like the feeling and the vibe in the air is more like the end and freedom and, you know, some time with your family and your friends. So it's really fun. Also, we all dressed up in like white clothes, so it's really nice, and we have like big meals, everyone together. I remember everyone, we go to my grandma's house and just like the whole family, it's really nice. And it's not one of those main holidays, like you said, even in Israel, but that what makes it special, because it's like a small holiday, but still like really important and really fun.
And it is, it's fun, and of course, the tradition is not to eat meat on Shavuot, right? To eat dairy products and all kinds of desserts and sweets and stuff like that. I assume it's the same in Israel.
So yeah, we eat a lot of dairy in Shavuot. And a lot of dairy.
It's not a good holiday if you're lactose intolerant.
No, really not. No,
nice.
Yeah. And it's just like, but instead, like it has so much more to it. I feel like, like one said, the vibe of freedom and the vibe of summer, like it's spring. It's just the great like weather.
Perfect weather, right.
Perfect weather, not too hot, not too cold. And we have a lot of other traditions in Shavuot, like that I don't see here a lot. Maybe mm-hmm. I'm just not in the right places, but
no,
we have
right.
a lot of hay rides. And we decorate the tractor and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and
we do hay rides at like Thanksgiving or Halloween or something.
Oh, really?
And
since,
yeah, nice. But it's not Jewish. We don't think about it that way, because yeah. it's not like Jewish farmers are the ones who settled the whole of America, unlike Israel, where there's kind of still a connection to the land.
Right, because we're a very agricultural land, just like you said. And because I'm from a moshav, we right. did a lot of
cooperative farms, right?
Yeah.
That's the whole idea.
And also we had like, we celebrated Shavuot as a moshav. We had this big event where there were like performances of people from the moshav and a lot of hay rides and competitions about the hay rides, like the most beautiful tractor win something or something like
the
that.
The most beautiful tractor.
Yeah, we decorated it.
Why does that
it.
Not sound like something that
you
happens in downtown
like
Tel Aviv?
Car.
I don't know.
No, definitely not. Definitely small moshavim or kibbutzim, you know, the community.
Right. In the periphery, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
okay.
nice.
It's awesome.
Well, it sounds fun. Flowers, right, on Shavuot?
Yes. Because
everything's blooming, and so garlands for your hair and decorations.
It's so
and
nice.
Everything.
I love
flower
it.
Crowns. And
flower
yeah.
crowns, right. Yeah.
And stuff like that, and water fights, which is
water fights.
Water fights.
So explain that one, because I don't remember reading about that in the Torah.
I have no
idea. Or even in the Talmud. I'm not sure where it came from, but so
I have no idea where it comes from. Uh-huh. We just do it. It's a tradition. We love it.
Warm
yeah.
weather, and so you go around spraying
yes.
each other. Water guns,
water
hoses,
guns.
Water
all
guns,
of the above.
Balloons,
water balloons,
everything.
It's really fun.
I will be very careful when I'm in Israel for Shavuot.
It's fun. You're going to have fun.
It is fun. I was in Jerusalem, though. People made a pilgrimage. They walked up to the Kotel. It was much more religious. But, of course, Jerusalem's a little more religious than lots of parts of Israel.
A little bit. A tiny little bit.
Yes.
Well, Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Hasif Sameach. You know, wonderful, happy Shavuot.
Happy Shavuot. Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the second portion of the book of Numbers, Naso, which includes a remarkable blessing. The Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing, is really three distinct brachot, three separate prayers, with which the ancient priests were commanded to bless the people. From its inception, this three-part blessing had exceptional importance. As the Torah quotes God saying, "With this blessing you will place my name on the people of Israel, Samu et Shemi." That is, this very blessing conveys God's presence among us and offers God's protection. The blessing was given by the Kohanim, highest class of priests, those who were entrusted with the service of the tabernacle and temple. We still use this blessing at every joyous life cycle event, and it remains powerful. The text is, "May God bless you and guard you. May the light of God's presence shine on you and be gracious to you. May God's presence turn to you and grant you peace." In essence, this Birkat Kohanim asks God to supply our most important needs. The majority of the interpretations of it see the first blessing as a request for physical safety, for health. The second asking for material needs to be satisfied, and the third blessing seeks spiritual comfort and confidence. Without any one of these blessings, our lives become challenging. With all three, we are assured of true quality of life. After thousands of years, those three elements, safety, grace, peace, remain central to our lives, a true gift from God. May you each be blessed with all of these, this week and always. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Francine Klagsbrun, the renowned author, will tell us secrets about Golda Meir, the pioneering Israeli hero and prime minister that we never knew. Find out what they are when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Well, we thought the Israeli election in April had given Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu another term heading the government. That would soon have made him the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's 71 years, surpassing founding Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. Netanyahu was hailed as the magician in the press, a politician of surpassing survival skills, who had apparently endured multiple corruption indictments and reestablished himself yet again as the leading figure in Israeli politics, as he has been for the last decade. Of course, Netanyahu still had to form a government, which in the world of parliamentary politics, especially in Israel, is never easy. Here's the way it works, or sometimes doesn't work. Since no one party ever wins the majority of the 120 seats in the Knesset, the unicameral house that is Israel's legislative body, that is, no party ever holds 61 seats all by itself, the process starts with the president of Israel, a mostly ceremonial role, inviting somebody to form the next government. The head of the party that wins the largest number of seats in the Knesset and who looks like he or she can assemble a coalition of parties to total at least the 61-vote majority, that person gets a set amount of time to put together a new government. That means that in this case, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin invited outgoing Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, head of the Likud party, which had just won the most seats in the Knesset, 35, translating to 35 votes out of the 61 he needed to be the next prime minister. He invited him to form the government. Netanyahu apparently had allies on the right side of Israeli politics and among the religious parties that would guarantee him another 30 seats, that is, 30 more votes, 65 out of 120, a pretty decent majority in Israel's fragmented politics. He had a month to form the government. What did that mean? That meant that Netanyahu and his lieutenants went to the smaller parties he wanted as allies and asked them what they wanted in return for joining his government. Those parties are all mostly allied with the Likud ideologically on some issues. Say they believe in taking a hard line with the Palestinians, or they want lower taxes, or they want more spending on settlements. But they don't agree with Likud on other issues, which is why they are not already in that party. Some of them very much want the religious ultra-Orthodox Haredi exemption from the draft preserved. Others absolutely want it removed. Some want more money for education so they can direct it their own flavor of religious schools. Some want better support for Russians or annexation of the West Bank. They all have their own issues that have appealed to some percentage of the electorate, which is why they got seats in the Knesset in the first place. Anyway, the second part of this is that the government of Israel has a number of ministries, and being the head of one of those ministries in the executive branch gives a person a lot of prestige, a lot of control, a lot of jobs and money to dispense. Big political power. These are the plum jobs in Israeli politics, really all of them, but in particular being head of, say, the defense ministry or the foreign ministry or the education ministry. All of these positions are allocated by the new government under the control of the prime minister. That is, he selects many of his cabinet from among the party leaders of other parties rather than his own in order to put together this coalition that can win 61 votes. Against this need to put together the coalition, the prime minister-to-be also has to balance support from his own party leaders, Likud politicians, who have brought in votes and have influence and power. Well, what happened over the last month of Israeli political negotiations is that Netanyahu tried, as he has done successfully many times, to balance the ideological purity of his potential coalition partners against their, well, ambition, let's say. So he promised important ministries to leaders of each of the largest blocks of votes, and he probably agreed to push certain issues they wanted pushed. Netanyahu has done this many times, and he assembled many improbable coalitions, more improbable than the one he was trying to put together this May. But he has never before done so while under multiple indictment for bribery and influence peddling, and while his potential partners know that he will want them to vote to give him immunity from prosecution. To put it mildly, this puts Netanyahu in a much weaker position than usual. Apparently, from the leaks we get about the process, what ultimately derailed this attempt to put together a government was the insistence of Avigdor Lieberman, who is plenty right-wing enough for Bibi, but is also a strong secularist who immigrated from the former Soviet Union, and he's a pretty headstrong guy himself with his own large political ambitions. Lieberman insisted that if his small party was going to be part of the government, then the preposterous exemption from military service for Haredi ultra-Orthodox yeshiva male students had to end. That would have taken the religious parties right out of the coalition, and eventually this impasse forced Bibi to call for yet another election, since he simply could not assemble 61 seats without both Lieberman's party and the religious parties. Phew! So, after all that, what's going to happen now in Israeli politics? Well, till the new election happens, Netanyahu stays as prime minister, as a lame duck. But of course, his party could win the next election. It may very well do so by a larger margin, perhaps. And then he'll be back in this exact spot, assembling a coalition with some of the same people. The hope is that the electorate will vote somewhat differently, and either he'll be able to put together the 61 votes he needs, or another party, say the blue-white Kahol Lavan party of Benny Gantz, will win more seats and be able to assemble its own government. In the meantime, it's status quo, more or less, through the summer. The new election will be September 17th, about 10 days before Rosh Hashanah. Never dull in Israeli politics. Russian dictator, president, Vladimir Putin attended the unveiling of a memorial viewed as Moscow's first Holocaust monument. The statue, depicting hands pulling open a door's shutters, was unveiled at Moscow's Jewish Museum. It commemorates Jewish resistance fighters. Although about half the victims of the Holocaust were citizens of our country, Moscow had no separate monument for the genocide, said German Zakharyayev, president of the Association of Mountain Jews. Moscow did have busts for saviors of Jews during the Holocaust and a plaque for the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, but it had no prominent monument to match those of Berlin, Warsaw, or Budapest. Under Soviet times, the authorities rarely acknowledged the Jewish victims of the Holocaust in literature or monuments, mentioning only Soviet citizens killed in World War II. Putin, however, called the Holocaust one of the greatest tragedies and most extraordinary chapters in history during the unveiling last week at the Jewish Museum and Tolerance Center. Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu jointly attended the laying of the monument's foundation stone a year ago. Victor Vexelberg, chairman of the museum's board of trustees, funded the monument's construction. It cost about $275,000. His father's entire family was imprisoned in a ghetto near his hometown Drobych in what is now Ukraine. He said only my father survived because he had fled earlier to join the militia. He called the monument's completion a symbolic watershed moment and milestone.
Now here's to the real author of the Caine Mutiny. Here's to you, Mr. Kiefer. If you want to do anything about it, I'll be outside. I'm a lot drunker than you are, so it'll be a fair fight.
Herman Wouk, the best-selling author of The Kane Mutiny, Marjorie Morningstar, The Winds of War, and War and Remembrance, died last week at the age of 103. The prolific writer was incredibly popular, incredibly prolific, incredibly durable, and much disliked by literary critics all at once. Wouk, an observant Orthodox Jew throughout his life, had an incredible career. The son of Jewish immigrants from Minsk, he graduated from Columbia, then worked as a writer for radio comedian Fred Allen. He enlisted in the Navy after Pearl Harbor, serving in the Pacific Theater as a radio officer on a destroyer and minesweeper in the South Pacific. He later said that his time in the Navy had been the greatest experience of his life. I had known two worlds, the wise guys of Broadway and the wise guys of Columbia, two small worlds that sometimes take themselves for the whole world, he said. In the Navy, I found out more than I ever had about people and about the United States. With his third published book, The Kane Mutiny, Herman Wouk struck gold. A crackling drama of the high seas leading up to a riveting courtroom scene, it introduced readers to the unforgettable Captain Philip Queeg, a seething blend of paranoia and incompetence, constantly fiddling with two steel ball bearings in his left hand. When Queeg steers the ship towards certain disaster in a typhoon, his junior officers remove him from command, an act for which they later face court-martial. That book sold more than 3 million copies in the U.S. alone, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1952, and was made into a movie in 1954 with Humphrey Bogart as Captain Queeg. Wouk adapted the courtroom sections of the novel into a hit Broadway play, The Kane Mutiny Court Martial, which opened the same year as the film, with Lloyd Nolan starring. His novel, Marjorie Morningstar, addressed Jewish assimilation successfully. He continued to write and publish regularly until his next wildly successful project, the World War II epic in two books, Winds of War and War and Remembrance, both made into a huge miniseries starring Robert Mitchum. Wouk later wrote a similar epic, less successful, about the founding of the State of Israel. His book about Jewish belief and practice, This Is My God, is still relevant and valuable. When he appeared on the cover of Time way back in 1955, Time magazine described Wouk's blend of worldly success and Jewish religious observance as paradoxical. He is a devout Orthodox Jew who has achieved worldly success in worldly wise Manhattan while adhering to dietary prohibitions and traditional rituals which many of his fellow Jews find embarrassing, the article said. I hope we have come a long way from that. Herman Wouk once wrote, "The person who rises from prayer a better person, that person's prayer has been answered." Herman Wouk's answer has come now at the age of 103. May the memory of this consummate storyteller continue to be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, the extraordinarily distinguished Jewish author Francine Klagsbrunn. Her book is called Lioness, Golda Meir and the Nation of Israel. It's now in paperback and deserves to be read by, I think, everybody with an interest in Israel, understanding the founding of the state, and a lot of what's going on today. Golda Meir understood America. She grew up in Wisconsin, and that became an incredibly important part of her initial service to the Zionist cause as maybe the best fundraiser Israel had in America. Can you talk about that period a little bit?
Absolutely. She was a great fundraiser. She understood America as none of the other leaders, none of the other founders of the state did. She spoke English perfectly with a bit of a Milwaukee accent. They all spoke with, you know, heavy Russian accents. So American Jews could relate to her in ways they could not relate to the other leaders. And she, for quite a while, over a year and a half or so, she headed the pioneer women. Today they're called Na'amat. She raised money through them to help the Women's Workers Council in Palestine. This was kind of a trade union of women workers. And she then went back and forth to the States and to Palestine, that's British-mandated Palestine in those days, raising money for them. But her greatest feat of money raising came in 1948 when the United Nations had already resolved to have partition.
Right, the partition vote had already taken place, and the fledgling nation of Israel was started, and boy, things were scary.
The nation was just about getting started. And David Ben-Gurion, who headed it, understood, and the whole world knew, that once they declared the state as such, the surrounding Arab nations were going to attack. And what they needed more than anything was ammunition. They had plans, they knew what to do, but they needed weapons to fight with. And to get those weapons, they needed money to buy the weapons. At that point, the Soviet Union was still Israel's friend. Later it became the Arabs' friend. And so the Soviet satellites, particularly Czechoslovakia, was willing to sell ammunition to this fledgling state, but they needed money. And so David Ben-Gurion sent Golda, her name at that point was still Meyerson. She was not yet Golda Meir. She became Golda Meir later. But at this point, he sent her to the United States to raise money. And she came on a freezing cold day. She had heard that there was a luncheon of well-heeled people going on in Chicago. And she approached a man named Henry Montour, who was the executive director of the UJA at that time. And she said, "I want to speak on that program." And he looked at her. He had heard of her. He said, "It's kind of a schnorrer, you know, one of those people who came occasionally to raise money." And he looked at her poorly dressed because there was little money in the pre-state Israel. Her hair back in what became her iconic bun, not a drop of makeup. But he thought, "I'll give her a chance." And so he sent her to that luncheon. And she came there, looked at these well-dressed people. Her knees were shaking. What would happen if she failed? They would not have the money they needed. And she stood there and she told the people of the Americans that they were going to be attacked and they were going to fight no matter what. But they needed money. And she ended by saying, "You, American Jews, can decide whether we will win or whether the Arabs win. You cannot make the decision for us whether we will fight. We will fight even if we have to fight with rocks. But you can decide whether we will win or whether the Arabs will win." And they looked at her, and she stood there so quietly and said this. There was like a moment of silence. And then, as Montour said, it was like an electric current that went through the whole luncheon. People got up and were so excited, and I practically threw pledges at her. They had been so impressed with her. And the next day, she began traveling around all the states for about a month and a half. And when she had finished, she raised $55 million, which is, in those days, this is, we're talking 48, was a huge amount of money. And they were able to buy all the equipment and all the ammunition that they needed. And Ben-Gurion then said that when history is written, it will be said that there was a Jewish woman who raised the money that made the state of Israel possible. And that was Golda.
It's a great story. You know, there's so much to talk about. In 1948, she also went to the Soviet Union. Could you talk about that sojourn?
She went once the state was declared. She was the first ambassador to the Soviet Union, and that was a time when nobody knew anything about the Jews of the Soviet Union. Elie Wiesel called them the Jews of silence, and that's sort of what it was. They were silent, they were repressed, they were part of, nobody knew much about the Soviet government altogether. And there was a misunderstanding in a sense on Israel's part, where they felt that the Soviet Union was being still friendly toward Israel, and they didn't quite understand that that didn't mean that they were that friendly toward their own citizens who wanted to identify with Israel. And so Golda came, and what she found were these repressed Jews, and when she tried to have open house on Friday night for the Jews to come, they didn't show up. And she began to understand how frightened they were, and there was so much secrecy, and her own rooms were being bugged, and she tried to work and tried to get them to get to know them. But then, on Rosh Hashanah, on the New Year, and on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, she went to the synagogue as she would do.
The Great Choral Synagogue in Moscow, I think, right?
It was a choral synagogue in Moscow. It's very I have not seen it, but it's one of the great synagogues. And she was there. People stared at her, but as she came out, tens of thousands of Jews, throwing caution to the wind, as it were, came out to see her, to greet her. They would call down to her, Golda, Golden, you, our Golda. They try to slip notes into her pocket to bring to relatives in Israel. And they overwhelmed her. She was almost in danger of so many people, and somebody pushed her into a taxi cab. And she leaned her head out the window, and all she could think to say was, thank you for having remained Jewish, because nobody knew whether they were Jewish or not. It turned out many of them suffered from that throwing cushion to the wind. They were KGB, Secret Service, Russian Secret Service, planted among them, recorded names, and some of them ended up in Siberia and in jail. But it was a most wonderful moment for them. And from then on, she was a great advocate for Soviet Jewry. She was very, very important in making the freedom of Soviet Jewry and having them come in the 90s to Israel. She was dead by then, but the work she had done way back from the 60s and the 70s, very secretive some of it, allowed that freedom to happen. Actually, Elie Wiesel had said to me that, I spoke with him, he was also a friend, but I also interviewed him, and he said that to this day, we don't even know everything that she did. We don't know the names of some of the people she spoke to because there's still families, you know, with those names, and they could get in trouble. So she, from that day, from that time as Soviet ambassador, she was very committed to that.
So she became prime minister at a very important time after the Six-Day War. She became the face of Israel, really, she and Moshe Dayan, I would say, and then went through the whole period of the Munich massacre, so many traumatic events. The Yom Kippur War was the downfall of her government. Explain a little bit about how that affected her and why the choices were made that were made at that time.
Well, it was a very complicated, and to this day, the feelings in Israel among many people, although I believe it's changing, but are different from the feelings among people in America, where we so revere her and respect her, and I have come to admire her so much as a result of doing so much research about her. But in Israel, the Yom Kippur War, although Israel won that war, which took place in 1973 against Egypt and Syria, although Israel won, they lost 2,600 soldiers, which is a huge number for Israel. And the war, Egypt and Syria had taken Israel unprepared. Although there was talk of war, they were not totally prepared. And Golda, as head of state, listened to her generals. Her generals, Moshe Dayan and Elie Zeira, who was the head of Amman, the military intelligence, who were sure there was not going to be a war. Anwar Sadat kept threatening war. Anwar Sadat had wanted Israel to return all the territories, which are, you know, still controversial today, that it had won in 1967, to return them, all of them, before they could negotiate any kind of peace. And Golda and everybody else, even the most left-wing people at that point, were not about to return everything without negotiations first. And so Anwar Sadat threatened war over and over again. But Golda's generals, Dayan and Elie Zeira, particularly Elie Zeira, believed that he was just bluffing, that Egypt was waiting for certain to get certain arms from the Soviet Union, and until it got those arms, it would not go to war with Israel, and that Syria would not go to war unless Egypt did. And Egypt had not gotten those arms. So whenever Golda worried about, you know, threats from Sadat or appearances of preparation for war, she was reassured that there is a low probability of war because they have not met what was called the conception, the concepción. And then war broke out. They had been warned last minute by a spy that it would break out that evening, October 6th, but it broke out in the afternoon at 2:30. And they were really not totally prepared. Their soldiers were not in place. Their weapons, their ammunition was not yet in place. They were.
They hadn't mobilized the reserves yet.
They had not mobilized the reserves. Well, they had just begun to, but not completely mobilized. I mean, and your listeners should understand that Israel does not have a standing army.
Right, right. So much of its strength.
That's their main army.
Right, of course.
So unless it's mobilized, you know, you don't have anyone to fight. So they were really unprepared in that way, and the first few days of the war were horrendous, and that's when Israel lost so many soldiers and so much ammunition. They really, Golda was really frightened that they were going to lose the war. But then it began to turn around, and then they did get this wonderful airlift from the United States that helped them. And they won the war, but as I say, it left such a bad feeling because they had been unprepared, but also because there was a sense of vulnerability that Israel had not had before. They now felt there was a sense that, yes, we could have lost. This could happen to us. And Golda, as head of state, was blamed, and Moshe Dayan, her general. And Moshe Dayan resigned at first. People were protesting. There were protests outside her office, and then she also resigned. However, she did remain, involved. It's not like she disappeared from the world after she resigned. She remained involved for a while. In fact, before Yitzhak Rabin took over for her, she negotiated a separation of troops between Israel and Syria. They were, now that Israel was winning, both Egypt and Syria wanted peace,
right?
And so she negotiated, before she left office, a separation of troops between Egypt and Israel. And then she left office, but then during that gap of time, there was a separation of troops between, a negotiation of separation between Israel and Syria. And she and Henry Kissinger was then United States Secretary of State. And the negotiations were very, very difficult. And at one point, Kissinger looked at her and said, "Mrs. Prime Minister, I am an American first, a Secretary of State second, and a Jew only last." And Golda said, "Well, that's okay, Henry, because in Hebrew we read from right to left."
Yeah, fantastic. So,
and in the end, they did arrive at an agreement, and that agreement, which had been firmed up, remained in place until our own times, actually.
I want to thank Francine Klagsbrun for a wonderful visit. We've really just scratched the surface of her remarkable biography, Lioness, Golda Meir and the Nation of Israel. I think everybody who cares about Judaism and Israel today should read it. It's an extraordinary book. Thank you so much. Francine, where can people go to? Great. Where can people go to find out more about you and the book?
I guess you can go online. Everything in the world is online, you know.
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Unfortunately, everything is.
Oh, yeah.
So, yes, me and the book as well. The book is now out in paper, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure, really.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Maxwell Greenberg, exploring the Jewish Latino identity here in the borderlands. Our playout this morning comes for today's celebration of the holiday of Shavuot. It's Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe Marasha Kehilat Yaakov. The Torah was given to us through Moses, an inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, a Chag Sameach for Shavuot today. By the way, services at Congregation Beit Simcha begin in just a few minutes. Come on by. And may you have a week, we pray, of peace.
sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.